Now we're going to read the Bible together. You'll find a copy of the Bible underneath the seat in front of you. There's a wee basket or the seat that you're sitting on. And it's the Good News Bible that we're reading from together. And we're going to read a passage from Matthew's Gospel, which is the first part of the New Testament of the Bible. Matthew was one of Jesus' disciples. He was a tax collector whom Jesus met and invited to follow him. And immediately Matthew left all his business concerns and his financial status and everything else behind and followed Jesus. And afterwards wrote what we call Matthew's Gospel. Matthew's Good News is what the word gospel means. He described his experience of life with Jesus. And here in Partick Trinity over the last few weeks, we've been reading bits of Matthew's Gospel to help us find out more about Jesus. And the very short passage we're going to read this morning is from Matthew's Gospel, chapter 10. The reference is up there on the board. Chapter 10 from verse 26. And if you've got one of our Bibles, it will be around about page 15. There's three slightly different versions of the Bible in the church, so it might be the page before or the page after if the number is differing. Oh, and it's not the first page 15 you'll find in the Bible either, because the Old Testament starts at page number 1, and there is a page 15 there. So if you've got page 15, but it says Genesis at the top of the page, then you're in the wrong place. Start from the back of the book and work forwards, and you'll come to page 15 of the New Testament, where we have Matthew's Gospel, chapter 10. Now, before I read this to you, let me just explain what's been happening. Jesus has been traveling around, performing miracles, gathering crowds of people who were all totally amazed at the things that he was able to do. Everywhere he went, a new town, a new village, a new group of people, they all saw for themselves and could hardly believe how wonderful were the things that Jesus was doing. But Jesus was aware that he was only one person, that he wouldn't be able to reach everybody himself and pass on his message to them, and therefore it would be necessary for him to recruit other people who he would send out to pass the message on. And that's how the church has worked. That's why we're here today, because people Jesus appointed told others, and they told others, and each person travelled on to somewhere new and passed the message on down through history. And that's how we got to where we are today, able to believe the things that Jesus tells us and pass them on to others. And all that starts at the beginning of Matthew chapter 10, where Jesus called the 12 disciples or the 12 apostles and began preparing them for the job of telling other people the good news about himself. And we have read in verses 1 to 25 the first pieces of instruction that he gave to people. Go from place to place, perform miracles, tell them about heaven, invite them to welcome you, but be aware of the possibility that they might persecute you, that they might put you on trial, they might punish you, your friends might betray you, things might go badly wrong. But the message is so important that you must carry on trying to spread it in spite of those dangers. And that's where we begin at verse 26 today. And that's when it starts by saying, so do not be afraid of people, even though they might betray you, even though they might put you in trial, even though they might punish you. This is what Jesus says. Do not be afraid of people. Whatever is now covered up will be uncovered, and every secret will be made known. What I am telling you in the dark, you must repeat in broad daylight. And what you have heard in private, you must announce from the housetops. Do not be afraid of those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather, be afraid of God, who can destroy both body and soul in hell. For only a penny, you can buy two sparrows. They sold sparrows in the market in Jesus' day. I think they made bird pie with them, if you're interested. But you got two for a penny, or really two for a 16th of a drachma. Very cheap. For only a penny, you can buy two sparrows. And yet not one sparrow falls to the ground without your Father's consent. And as for you, even the hairs of your head have all been counted. So do not be afraid. You are worth much more than many sparrows. And if anyone declares publicly that they belong to me, I will do the same for them before my Father in heaven. But if anyone rejects me publicly, I will reject them before my Father in heaven. There are, apparently, people in the world today who like loud music. The louder the better. They go out late at night, or sometimes even early in the morning. They go into dark rooms full of flashing lights. When they get there, they take off the vast majority of their clothes, and they spend the rest of the evening shaking their bodies about in time to the music. And they enjoy it. Fair play to them. When I was a teenager, they used to call them discos. Now they call them clubs. If you're one of those folk who's familiar with the bowling club, it's not quite like that. But whatever they call them, it makes no difference. They, under neither name do they appeal to me. They never have done, and I very much doubt if they ever will. Nevertheless, I have no problem with people who want to go and do that. If you want to go and spend your time in that way, so long as you don't inflict it on me or expect me to come with you, I'm very happy with that. And just the same way that I'm happy for some people to spend their time outside in the garden pulling up weeds and planting flowers, go for it. Keeping budgerigars, one or two folks I know are very keen on that, and that's absolutely fine. Some people play chess and form clubs and societies and get together and do that, and that's great. And as far as I'm concerned, you can go and do any of these really strange things. So long as you don't expect me to get involved, leave me free to go to my rugby matches, to listen to the kind of music I enjoy, to go hill walking, to be myself, to do what suits me. And that's very much the kind of world that we live in. Tolerance has become almost the only virtue in our society that really matters. I can do whatever I want so long as it doesn't have a negative impact on anybody else, and you must let me. You must not try to stop me or impose your values on me. And only if the things that each of us are trying to do get in each other's way might there be a problem. We live in a tolerant or an inclusive society. But what about religion? What is the place of religion in our world, and in particular Christianity? Can it be included as one of those things that certain strange people can come into a building on Sunday morning, keep most of their clothes on, listen to organ music and slightly less loud music than you get in the discos, shake their bodies out only quietly, and spend their time reading the Bible and praying to God? They can do that so long as they don't expect other people to join in. Can we allow Christianity to fall into that category of private things that it's up to every individual? You probably know there was a minor stooshy in the press this week because the Pope complained that Roman Catholics in particular and Christians in general were not free to do what they wanted, that legislation that had been passed was restricting Christian freedom. He wasn't specific about exactly what he meant, but most of the commentators think he was referring both to the insistence that Roman Catholic adoption agencies work with gay couples, in spite of the teaching of the Roman Catholic Church and most other Christian churches about the immorality of homosexual practice, and also about recent legislation which makes it more difficult for any religious body, Christian or otherwise, to insist that the people whom they employ need to be Christians. That could be a breach of their human rights, and you might not be able to make that requirement. And so the Pope was saying that there is a clash between human rights and religious freedom. Human rights legislation has meant that believers cannot always do what they think is right, sometimes cannot even say it, because it's offensive to others. Well, think about that, and think about our Bible reading this morning and what Jesus was saying to his disciples. Because what he is doing is making it very clear in verse 27 of our reading, making it very clear that they should have an impact on others. That the religion they were acquiring or the things that they were coming to believe through his teaching, they couldn't simply keep to themselves in a darkened room or in private. What I am telling you, he says in verse 27, you must repeat in broad daylight. And what you have heard in private, you must announce from the housetops. In the kind of village where Jesus lived, as you probably know, in Palestine, most of the houses would have been low with flat roofs. So to go up onto the flat roof of the house and announce from the housetop was a way of making sure that the whole village heard, whether they wanted to or not. It was a public announcement that imposed itself upon everybody living in the district. So the equivalent today would be open-air broadcasts, live music in the park, or perhaps an internet campaign or something by text message which forces its way into everybody's living space. Active steps taken by those who believe to persuade those who are not yet committed. Are we entitled to take those steps today, or should religion be a private matter? Obviously, people should be allowed to convert to whatever faith they want to. Religions like ours, Christianity, should be ready to answer inquirers if they come to us with questions. But what about going out? What about what we call mission or outreach? Persuading people? Interfering in their lives? If others choose not to believe what I believe and aren't even interested in finding out what I believe, should I not be content with that and leave them at peace? Well, two things that Jesus says in his passage that we read this morning have a bearing on that. And the first of them is this. In verse 27, he says, what I am telling you in the dark, you must report in broad daylight. What I am telling you is what you must pass on. So Christianity is a revealed religion. It's not something that believers have decided for themselves or worked out for themselves, perhaps using faulty logic or betraying their prejudices. We are simply believing what we have heard from Jesus, retelling what we have been told. In the Christian story, as you possibly know, Jesus is described as the Word of God. So he is not just God's messenger, he is also God's message. The message he brings is about himself. The message from God is basically, meet my Son, and through him, meet me. Because all of God's character and all of his feelings for us, the way he treats us, are wrapped up and presented to us in human form in Jesus. Someone that we can relate to, someone that we can understand. So in telling people about Jesus, we are introducing them to God. Jesus says, what I am telling you, you must report or repeat in broad daylight. So where the music that I like depends on my tastes, or the hobbies that I participate on depend on my likes and dislikes, my interests, perhaps the things that I'm good at. Probably even the friendships I have depend on my character and my personality as I bond with like-minded people. So all of these things are personal to me. They're my taste, my hobbies, my friends, and things that are true for me to say that I like or I enjoy might not be true for you. But if Jesus is the Word of God, the message from God about God, and if God is not just a figment of my imagination or an extension of my personality, in other words, if what I believe as a follower of Jesus is true, then it must be true for everyone. as the world is round, or the grass is green, whether people believe it or not. If something is absolutely true in that sense, not just a matter of taste, then unbelief does not make it untrue. It just makes the unbeliever wrong. Now, I'm not trying to say that Christians are never wrong about anything. That would be impossible to state, not least because Christians are very good at disagreeing with one another about what they believe. But let's try not to be distracted by that this morning, because what's really remarkable about what Christians believe is that around the world and over the years and across the generations at any one time and between the different denominations, people who have become Christian believers with an infinite variety of tastes and personalities and backgrounds and cultures nevertheless keep reforming what they believe to the same core thing. They keep coming back to the gospel message, the story of Jesus Christ that he shared with his disciples. And that means when we take that core message that all Christians have always believed, we have only two possibilities. One is that it is true, and therefore everyone should believe it. And the other is that it is not true, and therefore no one should believe it. But what makes no sense at all is that some people should believe it, whether it's true or not. You cannot have that middle road where it's true for me and not true for you. It's true for me that Mars bars taste lovely, but other people can't stand the taste of them. But it's true for me that Jesus is the Son of God. And if that is true, if I'm right, then it's true for you as well, no matter what you think about it. And therefore, you cannot expect those who think it is true to keep it to themselves. If God has told believers to act it out and pass it on, what kind of believers would we be if we disobeyed him in order not to offend someone else who thought we should keep quiet? Of course, we don't go out of our way to be offensive. And sometimes we do get it wrong and get carried away and are rude or overbearing. And sometimes we need to apologize for the way that we have said the things that we believe. But if what gives offense is the truth, however well we present it, well then, as believers in Jesus, we are not at liberty not to give that offense or to keep it to ourselves. We are simply passing on what we have been told. And if we believe that what we have received is true, we must pass it on. And then something else Jesus says in our reading this morning really impresses upon us the importance that he attaches to that passing on of what we believe. And it comes in the second half of verse 28. Let me introduce it to you like this. You may have noticed in the High Court in Glasgow on Friday of this week, a man was sentenced to 32 years in prison for having committed truly horrible crimes. And apparently, according to the press report, as he was being led out to begin his sentence, someone shouted from the public gallery to him, "I hope you rot in hell." Okay? Now, that's not a very nice thing to say to anyone, "I hope you rot in hell." But nevertheless, I think we could understand how someone in the public gallery, particularly if it was someone who had a personal connection to the victims of this man's terrible crime, we can understand how they would feel like that and how such a strong expression of hatred would be just come straight from the heart. And we need to remember to pray for the victims of crimes like that and for the pain that they will go on to suffer for long years after the rest of us have forgotten. "I hope you rot in hell." But now look at what Jesus says to back up his instruction to his followers that they should broadcast his teaching in public. In the second half of verse 28, he says, "Be afraid of God, who can destroy both body and soul in hell." Now that's exactly the same kind of strong language, which surely does indicate how very strongly Jesus feels about this. It sounds very like a threat. And any Christian who has heard the message of the gospel and believed it, but is thinking of keeping it to themselves, needs to read this verse very carefully and wonder what Jesus thinks about that. But is this really what he means? Does it really add up to say that Jesus is threatening with the prospect of hell people who choose not to pass on what they believe? Well, if you know the rest of the gospel message, then you will know that that cannot possibly be what Jesus means here, because the gospel message is one of sins forgiven. No matter what you have done, no matter how many mistakes you make, hurting others, shaming yourself, disappointing God, there is an offer not only of free forgiveness, but of complete forgetting through the love of God and through faith in Jesus Christ as Savior and Lord. God loves us. And in his famous passage about love in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, one of the things that Paul tells us is that love keeps no record of wrongs. So at the very core of the Christian message, as people come to faith, is the reassurance that says you've now got nothing to be frightened of. And three times in other parts of the passage that we read this morning, Jesus said to his disciples, "Do not be afraid." So he simply cannot be saying here to people who have heard and believed his message that if they will not pass it on, they are in danger of being destroyed, both body and soul, in hell. That would be like threatening the ferry passenger who has just been rescued from the sinking ship and has now got their feet back on dry land, saying to them, "Watch out, you're in danger of drowning." So why does Jesus raise the possibility of hell in this passage? Why does he use such strong language here? It's clearly not a threat to believers, because they believe that they have been saved from the dangers of hell. And it's clearly not a threat to unbelievers either, because they don't believe that hell exists, so they don't feel threatened by it. So what I think is happening here is that Jesus mentions it to say his disciples, not, "If you don't tell other people what I have told you, then this is what might happen to you." But if you don't tell other people what I have told you, then this is what might happen to them. You see? The mission of the church, which reflects the motive for coming to earth of Jesus himself, is not fear driven by God, the master recruiting sergeant, conscience driving his privates to see so many unconverted people as so much potential pew fodder that they'd better drum into church, otherwise God will be angry with them for not making up their quota. No. The mission of the church, reflecting the motive of Jesus himself, is love drawn by believers acutely aware of how much more we have received than we deserve, and not wanting others to miss out. Not wanting them to lift up the bowl and find that there's nothing there underneath. It is impossible to believe what Christians believe and not believe it matters very much indeed. Someone has said it's like one beggar showing other beggars where to find bread. What Jesus really means here is something more like this. It's like one person who has escaped from drowning or the fire or whatever else, going back in to rescue others. Now, maybe you feel the language is too strong. Do people today still believe in hell? Does Jesus mean us to take it literally? Well, the very least we can say is this, that he came with a message about himself, which he said, if it is believed, brings life. And life with Jesus is life in all its fullness, lived out for all eternity. Which means that if the message is not believed, wherever we end up not believing will be apart from him. And if God is the source of life and light, of love and hope and joy and peace, then what else could it be apart from destruction to be apart from him? The worst of all possible fears that God is not there coming true. Even way back in the past, when preachers were better known for preaching hell, fire, and judgment and trying to scare people into deciding to follow Jesus, even then a guy called John Donne wrote this. He said, when all is done, the hell of hells, the torment of torments, is the everlasting absence of God. To fall out of the hands of the living God is a horror beyond our expression. Now, maybe you're sitting there thinking to yourself, I wish you weren't going on and on about this morning. What on earth are you doing preaching about hell, especially at a guest service, for goodness sake, when we're trying to make folks feel welcome? Would it not be better to talk about the love of God, at least this Sunday morning? But you see, this is the love of God that Jesus is talking about. Not the sending of people to hell as a punishment, but the saving of people from it. The not separating of himself from us, but his joining of himself to us forever. And that's what the rest of this passage expresses, that picture, even of two sparrows that can be bought for a penny, that will not fall to the ground without her Father in heaven noticing. Is he not paying attention to us this morning? Without even a hair in our heads going uncounted, how much more must he know about us, even than we know about ourselves? What chance do you think that you would have of making friends with someone who knew everything about you? Or getting a job from someone who knows everything about you? Maybe you've been preparing for a job interview sometime and you've thought to yourself, I'd better not say that or let on about that just yet in case they find out and don't give me the job. And maybe for all of us, there are still some things we are trying to hide, even from those who know us best, because we are scared of what they'll think about us. Well, even the number of hairs in your head, and therefore presumably also what goes on inside your head, is known to our Father in heaven, and yet still, he wants us to hear this invitation, and he wants us to come to him. He's looking forward with eager enthusiasm to that relationship being made complete. Very many years ago, when I was in my very early 20s as a boys' brigade officer, six of my boys, the class that I was looking after, went in for their Queen's badge. And at the end of the year, all of them got it. And you know anything about the mysteries and rituals of the boys' brigade movement, that's a huge, significant achievement. And quite rightly, they were very, very pleased with themselves when they went to the city chambers to get their badges presented, and they were represented at our own company display in front of all the church and their family and friends. They were really, really pleased with themselves. And you could tell that by looking at their faces. But I'll tell you this, they weren't half as pleased as I was, because these were my boys and I'd worked with them and helped them along the way and done everything I possibly could. And I was so proud of what they had done. And Jesus knows here the fear that things might go wrong. Verse 33, he says, if anyone rejects me publicly, then I will be left with no choice but to reject them before my Father in heaven. I'm not going to force into eternal fellowship with God anyone who doesn't want to be there. I think that's what he's saying. But it's also very clear that is not what he wants. That shaming us and showing us up in front of his Father is not what drives him. And what he really wants to say to his Father is this: look who's here. And isn't it wonderful that they have come? I'm so pleased that they've made it. If anyone declares publicly that he belongs to me, then I will do the same for them before my Father in heaven. So I'm sorry if you're someone who is not yet a Christian and takes offense at the way that we go on and on about Jesus. I'm sorry if you get a leaflet through your letterbox sometimes that you'd rather not have to read. Or you hear the music coming out from church sometime when you're walking past and you think it's a nuisance. I'm sorry if you get annoyed when people give you things to read or invite you along to events. I'm sorry for you if you take offense at those things. But it's not within my power or the power of the church to do anything less. In fact, we really ought to be doing more. It wasn't within Jesus' power to come and keep quiet, even though it killed him, to do what he did and said what he said. But it is within his power to say to you, you're welcome to come and enjoy these things with me. I don't know what heaven will be like, what kind of music, or whether it will be full of budgerigars or people playing chess. But I do know that it will be with him. And I do know that he wants you to be there. And I do know that he loves you. And I do know that someone who loves you is going to do everything he can to make it good for you. It's true. And I pray that God will show us all that it's true. And that we will be ready to respond to his love and to receive his blessing.